the vesicles in one part of the Golgi contain the proteins headed for one site in the cell, and in one part we have a vesicle budding off that's going to be targeted to lysosomes. And this goes then to endosomes through a vesicle, which I left out. So we have a vesicle. Okay. Now, in the lysosome, we have sorting, just as we talked about with receptor-mediated endocytosis. And so the receptor ends up in one part of the endosome, and the hydrolase in another. Now, notice this looks exactly like the picture from receptor-mediated endocytosis, and it is indeed the same, that material from the Golgi, just like some of it, just like material from the outside, all converge on an endosome. And in the endosome, in the acidic environment, many ligands and receptors separate, and there is a sorting out of things to be recycled and things to be degraded. So the vesicle, it buds off here, contains the hydrolase ready to go to the lysosome. But the receptor is going to bud, a membrane containing the receptor in a vesicle is going to bud off a different part of the endosome. And so these two vesicles now have different fates. The one carrying the hydrolase is going to either become a lysosome, becoming more acidified, or it is going to meet and fuse with a pre-existing lysosome to deliver more enzymes. On the other hand, what about this receptor? Where should we send it to? We should send it back where it came from, which in this case is actually the Golgi. And that's exactly what happens. Now, this is the normal state of affairs. But we know about a condition called I-cell disease, or ICD. And in I-cell disease, this process messes up, and in fact, that's how we know about it. That what happens in I-cell disease is because of a mutation, this enzyme that adds mannose-6-phosphate is missing. Now, what should be the consequence? To make it clearer, maybe we should go back here and add a few more. These are all hydrolases, say different ones, heading for a lysosome eventually. Now, normally, all of them get M6P added. They're different proteins, but they all have the sequence which the enzyme recognizes, and so M6P is added to all of them. So normally, all of them cluster in the appropriate area of the Golgi, bind to receptors, go to endosomes, and end up in vesicles heading for the Golgi. Heading for the lysosome. But what happens now if the enzyme for adding M6P is missing? What's going to happen to our enzymes? And for this, I think I need some colored chalk. So what's going to happen is in I-cell disease, since the enzyme doesn't work, the modifying enzyme, there's no M6P on the hydrolases. So now when it's time to bind to receptors, are they going to bind? There's nothing to attach the enzymes to the normal receptors. And so the enzymes end up in the part of the Golgi where things that have no other address go. And so what's going to be the consequence? They're going to end up in the vesicle that normally goes to the surface. Now, if this vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, where will our hydrolase end up? Is it going to be in the membrane or outside? It's going to be outside because we're going to fuse the two, open up the membrane, and whatever was in here is going to end up outside the cell. So instead of ending up in lysosomes, the hydrolases are going to be outside the cell. Now, why is this called eye disease? Because the cells have inclusions. The cell forms lysosomes, but they don't have their hydrolases. They have their substrate to be degraded, but they have no hydrolases to break, do the degradation. So as a result, the lysosomes just sit around. Draw it over here. The lysosomes just sit around with the substrate inside, and it doesn't get degraded. And these visibly undigested piles of junk is what is recognized in this disease, and that's why it's called inclusion or eye cell disease. Now, this disease affects certain tissues and not others. And since some tissues, such as the liver, are not affected, it means that in those cells, the hydrolases must get to lysosomes in some other way. And we don't know what that is. But we know that in many cells, this is how it works, because it screws up in eye cell disease. Now, what are the problems here? Why is eye cell disease a problem? There's actually two angles here. First of all, these hydrolases are out here in the extracellular space where they are not supposed to be, so they can cause damage. They cause limited damage because it's not that acidic out here, so the enzymes don't work that well. After all, they're all acid hydrolases. But in addition to causing damage by being where they're not supposed to be, their lack of presence in the lysosome causes junk to accumulate. You can't do normal recycling. So the cell person gets it at both ends. Now, before we go any further, what does this say about how many sequences or signals a protein must have in order to go to a lysosome? What does it take to normally get here? So I want you to think about that for a minute. How many signals does it take? The signals must be encoded in the protein itself. But how many special sequences are needed for a protein to end up here? So I want you to think about that for a minute. We'll take a look. Okay, how many people think it doesn't take any? Zero. One. Two. Three. Okay, I think it's one or two here. So somebody want to say about one? Why one? Some brave soul? Yes. Well, you have to have the sequence that the enzyme recognizes to add M6P. So I wouldn't say bind to M6P, but that recognized by the enzymes to add M6P, because it's a covalent addition. So you definitely need the recognition site for M6P addition. But I happen to agree with the twos. You need something else. Will one of the twos say what the other one is? You had to go to the ER first. You had to have a general signal, take me to the ER. And then, of all the things in the ER, you have to have the signal that says, take me to lysosomes. So you have to have probably two. One to enter the ER, that would be the signal peptide, recognized by the signal recognition particle. And then, once you get to the Golgi, you need the M6P addition. Now, what about this protein? How many signals does it have? It only has one, because it had one to get into the ER, and then it follows from there what is the default pathway of automatically going into a vesicle which fuses with the plasma membrane. Now, this is one kind of lysosomal disease where all of the enzymes are misdirected because the modification enzyme isn't working. There are other diseases which are classical lysosomal storage diseases. And in these, one lysosomal enzyme is missing or doesn't work. There are maybe 20 different enzymes in a lysosome. There are 20 different diseases here. In each one, a different particular enzyme is missing. An example of this is Tay-Sachs disease, where the enzyme to break down a complex lipid is missing, and Gaucher's disease. And there are many others. Now, how is this different? How many different mutations are there in a person with eye cell disease? How many genes are messed up? One. Both copies, but only one. It's the gene for this enzyme, for the modifying enzyme. In a case of Tay-Sachs disease, however, even though only one gene is messed up, how many enzymes don't go where they're supposed to? A whole lot, like about 20. They're all made, but they go to the wrong place. In this case, only one enzyme is defective. How many mutations? Again, one. One of the genes for one of the enzymes is defective. Both copies, but only one. Now, it turns out you can't do anything, we think, about eye cell disease, but you can do something about some of these, in particular, Gaucher's. This has been done the most, and the same procedure has now been used for a few others. This is one of the few cases where you can use enzyme replacement therapy. And in order to understand how it works, we have to look at what is called the salvage pathway. If we go back to our picture here, if you consider the normal situation, is that lysosomal enzymes go only to lysosomes, and the receptors for those enzymes go through endosomes and recycle back to the Golgi. But we know that at least in some cells, both of these processes sometimes make mistakes. It may be functional, it may just be accidental. But what happens is that these vesicles sometimes, both of them, fuse with the plasma membrane. Now let's see what the consequences would be. If this vesicle fused with the plasma membrane instead of the lysosomal membrane, so here's the vesicle, and here's the hydrolase. Where will the hydrolase end up? Outside the cell. Same case as before, hydrolase will end up outside. Now, this is a little different than eye cell disease, because in eye cell disease, not only do all the hydrolases end up outside, but none of them have mannose-6-phosphate. Here we're saying a few hydrolases end up outside, and they have mannose-6-phosphate on them. However, we think that not only these vesicles headed for lysosomes make a mistake, but sometimes these vesicles, instead of recycling to the Golgi membrane, recycle to the plasma membrane. Now, what will happen if one of these vesicles fuses with the plasma membrane? Where will the receptor end up? Will it end up outside the cell? All of it? No, it's going to stay locked in the membrane, but with its binding part on the outside. So we're going to open up the vesicle. And now, maybe I'll draw it over here. What's going to happen is that some of these M6P receptors are going to be on the surface of the cell. Now, that allows you to salvage some of the enzymes that accidentally got out of the cell. Because these that accidentally got out of the cell have mannose-6-phosphate on them. So they will bind to the receptor. Now, why does this help? When you bind a receptor and its ligand, what is the usual result? You get endocytosis. And endocytosis would produce first coated pits, then coated vesicles, uncoated vesicles. And in fact, they would look exactly like this. So what you will get is a vesicle which fuses with an endosome, and now we get exactly the same sorting that we're supposed to get. The lysosomal enzyme is in fact going to be sent to a lysosome. Now usually if you add an enzyme to a cell, if it gets into the cell, what happens to the enzyme? Well, if I did that with an ordinary enzyme, I sent it to an enzyme, endosome, and then to a lysosome, what would happen to it? Chomp, 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 it would be degraded. So most of the time, you can't add an enzyme from the outside, just gets degraded. But this enzyme is special. This enzyme is supposed to be in degradation heaven. This enzyme is resistant to degradation by hydrolases, and you're sending it exactly where it's supposed to go. This is a little like Brer Rabbit saying, don't throw me in the briar patch. The briar patch is bad for most people, but it's perfect for a rabbit. The lysosome is bad for most enzymes, but it's the perfect working environment for a hydrolase. So the few receptors that accidentally reach the surface recapture the few lysosomal enzymes that accidentally reach the surface, bring them back in, and send them where they're supposed to go. In fact, it is possible that some enzymes actually are supposed to reach lysosomes by this method. We don't know. Now, how does this come in handy? In Gaucher's disease, one of the hydrolases is missing. Cerebrosidase, one enzyme, is missing. So what happens if you add that enzyme? If you add the enzyme which is missing in Gaucher's disease, it can be taken up by endocytosis, sent to the lysosome, and it cures the symptoms of the disease. And this is very effective. It's been used for this disease and two or three other lysosomal diseases. Now, there's a catch. What does the enzyme have to look like in order to work? Can I add enzyme that looks like this? If I add an enzyme without mannose-6-phosphate, it won't stick to the receptor, it won't be picked up by the salvage pathway, and it'll just stay on the outside. I have to add an enzyme that has mannose-6-phosphate on it. And the problem is that the only way to get such an enzyme is by producing the protein in animal cells. Normally, when you want to make a human protein in large amounts, you put the appropriate gene in bacteria, and the bacteria make your protein. And it's relatively cheap. But bacteria can't add mannose-6-phosphate. And so it's necessary to put the gene into animal cells and let them make the modified enzyme. And this is very expensive. This is probably the world's most expensive drug. It costs about $50,000 a year per patient. And this is not a one-time thing that you get over. This is something that lasts for the rest of your life. Now, can you get bacteria to put the mannose-6-phosphate on? That's what people are trying to do. Bacteria don't naturally have the genes to do it. But the hope is to put the genes in the bacteria in order to do it, but it's a complex process, so it takes a lot of genes. But that's the hope, to eventually genetically engineer bacteria so they will churn out these modified proteins and it will become a lot cheaper. All right, why can't you do that to cure eye cell disease? Yeah? How do you give the person the enzyme? I think it's IV. But now I have a question for you. Why can't you do the same thing in eye cell disease? So why don't you think about that for a minute? And maybe discuss it with the person next to you. It's too quiet in here. Is some brave soul willing to volunteer why you can't do it? Why can't you just add the missing enzyme? Yeah?
The problem is not the lack of enzyme, it's the lack of the protein is affected, it's the lack of acceptance.
Well, he says it's not the enzyme that's the problem, it's the protein. But it depends what you call an enzyme. The problem here is not with the hydrolases that function in lysosomes. The problem here is with an enzyme that functions in the Golgi. So if you add this enzyme, it will not be targeted to the Golgi and do its thing. It will be targeted to the lysosome and degraded, if it's taken up at all. So why don't you just add the hydrolases? Too many and too much money. $50,000 each times at least 10 a year. So that's out of the question. So you can't do it. You can't use enzyme replacement therapy for eye cell disease. And in fact, this disease is almost invariably fatal. What we'll be able to do about it, I don't know. Maybe some of you eventually will think of something. Yes?
Do you need the mannose-6-phosphate to get the receptors to go to the surface?
Do you need the mannose-6-phosphate receptors?
Do you need the mannose-6-phosphate for it to bind so that the receptors will go to the calcium membrane and carry?
I think her question is, could you somehow get a receptor from here to go back to the Golgi and carry this enzyme into the Golgi instead?
Well, no, like, if the enzyme doesn't get the mannose-6-phosphate onto the protein, and it doesn't bind to the receptor, how does the receptor then
go to the I think her question is, if what happens if there is no mannose-6-phosphate to these receptors? Is that your question? I'm not sure what happens. Either the receptors just sit here and don't go anywhere, or the empty receptors cycle around back and forth, but don't carry anything. So that's what happens in eye cell disease. But I'm not sure which of them it is. Now, I want to leave lysosomes, because this is basically what I wanted to talk about with lysosomes, and talk about some of the other organelles in the cell. A while ago, when we talked about how proteins get where they're supposed to go, we said you have a ribosome, and it starts making a protein. And there are two possibilities. If the protein has a signal peptide, then the whole ribosome mRNA complex attaches to the ER. The protein enters the endomembrane system. It goes to some part of the endomembrane system, or it's secreted. But if there is no signal peptide, then the ribosome remains in the cytoplasm, and the protein is made completely. And what we want to do now is consider what happens to these proteins. We've left that half. Now, how do these proteins get into mitochondria, peroxisomes, etc., the things that are not part of the endomembrane system? Now, we know that if this protein has no signals of any kind on it, if it has nothing, then it just stays in the cytoplasm. But if it has the appropriate sequence, it can be targeted either to the nucleus, to mitochondria, or to peroxisomes. There are probably others, but these are the ones we're going to talk about today, how it gets into these. And we're going to really start, I think, with mitochondria. Now, in a way, the easiest way to do this is to compare what gives with mitochondria to what gives with lysosomes, because we spend a lot of time talking about lysosomes. For example, we know that a lysosome looks more like this, and a mitochondrion like this. So one big difference between them is the number of membranes that they have. And therefore, if a protein goes in or out, it's a more complicated, it's a different business. So there's a table in your notes, and I'll write it up, but if you don't get all the details, there is there in your notes, that if you ask about my membranes, lysosomes have one, and mitochondria have two. And another big difference is DNA. Lysosomes don't have DNA, but mitochondria do. Mitochondria don't have very much DNA, but they have a little bit. And that has implications. First of all, if there's DNA in them, if one mitochondrion is going to make two, how are you going to do it? You have to copy the DNA, and then you have to divide the mitochondrion in half and put one copy in each half. So they actually grow and split. Now, lysosomes don't. We don't think lysosomes get bigger and bigger and split in half. We think that you make one, and then when you need another one, you just make another one new. You take some new enzymes and a new membrane, and you start over. So that's quite different. So where do you make the proteins that end up in these organelles? We just finished saying that the way you make... Where is the protein made? The protein that's going to end up on lysosomes is made on the rough ER. But the proteins that are going to end up in mitochondria, where do they come from? They actually come from two different sources. Some of them are actually made inside the mitochondrion using the DNA of the mitochondria. Mitochondria are thought to be a kind of degenerate descendant of bacteria. They have lost most of their DNA, but retained a little bit. And they have many prokaryotic features. Their DNA is circular, their ribosomes are more like prokaryotic than eukaryotic, etc. But they have not only DNA, but all the equipment you need for transcription and translation, that is, to use that DNA to make proteins. So their proteins, some of them are made by themselves inside, but almost all of their proteins, the vast majority, are made on cytoplasmic ribosomes. That is, they're made on the free ribosomes as versus the ribosomes attached to the ER. Now, given this difference, when do the proteins actually enter a membrane or a lumen? Proteins don't directly enter lysosomes. Proteins enter the ER, and then vesicles carrying them butt off and go to the Golgi, etc., etc. But the protein that is going to end up in a lysosome originally enters the ER co-translationally. So import into the ER is co-translational. If the protein's going to be in a membrane, it's inserted into the membrane as it's made. If the protein's going to be inside a membrane, it's inserted into the lumen as it is made. Now that's different for mitochondria. If these proteins are going to enter mitochondria, they're made first, and then they're carried over to mitochondria and wiggle into the mitochondria. So import is post after translation. Now this has an implication. If a protein is wiggling into the ER as it's made, you don't need to push it in with any energy besides the energy of the growth of the protein chain. As the protein grows, that's a sufficient push so it goes in. So you don't need added energy. You do need energy to get the ribosome attached to the translocon and start. But you don't need a continual supply of energy to push the peptide chain. But that's different when you have post-translational insert. You have to actually shove the protein in across the membrane. And that requires energy. And given mitochondria, it can be either ATP or a proton gradient. You remember that mitochondria, as a result of carrying out electron transport, have a proton gradient, and the protons falling down their concentration gradient produce ATP. So you can use the ATP for something, but you can also use the gradient instead to do the pushing. So either one can be used to push the protein in. Now, what about this signal business? We said that to get into a lysosome, you need a signal peptide to be sent to the ER. And then you need a second signal for addition of mannose-6-phosphate in order to get to the actual lysosome. Both of these are sequences within the protein itself. Well, how do you get to a mitochondrion? Usually there is a sequence in the protein at the amino end, which is called a transit peptide. If if a short sequence says, take me to the ER, it's called a signal peptide, and it binds to the signal recognition particle. If you have a sequence which says, take me to a mitochondrion, it's called a transit peptide, and it also binds to specific things, but they're not as well understood, and we're not going to talk about them. But how does a protein actually get into a mitochondrion? If I blow up my mitochondrion a bit, that's the outer membrane, and here's the inner membrane. There are regions where the inner and the outer membrane are right next to each other, and that's called a contact point. And that's where the protein is thought to go in to enter into the matrix. That is, the part in the middle. With mitochondria, you have a problem. You not only have to get the protein into this thing, but you have to get it in the right place. And there are quite a lot of possibilities here. It can go in the matrix, it can go in the inner membrane, it can go in the intermembrane space, or it can go in the outer membrane. And proteins have to be targeted to all of those. And the one that's best understood is how you get things into the matrix. It turns out that there are pores or channels, much like a translocon, in each of these membranes. So if I drew it properly like that. And at a transit point, the two pores are aligned to form essentially a single tube or channel, so that protein can go in one pass from the outside to the inside of the mitochondrion. So the protein goes in like this, transit peptide first. It may form a loop as with the regular translocon in the ER, I don't know. But it goes in approximately amino end first. And we know that once it gets inside, the transit peptide is removed, just as the signal peptide on the end is usually removed when proteins enter the ER, courtesy of an enzyme inside the matrix. And it's thought that perhaps removal of this peptide prevents the protein from transporting across other membranes incorrectly. Now, in order to get across through this channel, the protein must be unfolded. Maybe we should write that here. Probably the way that happens is when the protein is made, it associates with a chaperone or a chaperonin, which prevents it from folding up. The alternative is that it combines with a chaperone, which unfolds it when the moment comes. So it's either kept unfolded, or it's unfolded when it's time for passage using a chaperonin. So there's one chaperone on this side, but there's a second chaperone because once the protein chain gets inside, it has to fold up in three dimensions. So there's another chaperone on the inside. One probably to help it unfold, and one to help it fold up properly. Now, this explains how you could get a protein into the matrix. But how do you get a protein anywhere else in any of these other compartments? We think there's more than one way to do it. One possibility is that a protein comes from the outside, and it enters this membrane and gets stuck in the membrane. So that's one way to put a protein into the outer membrane, much the way you put it into an ER, except you do it after synthesis instead of during synthesis. Now, what about the intramembrane space? Either the protein goes all the way through the outer membrane, or another possibility is the protein enters the matrix and then crosses the inner membrane. It's not clear which, and it may depend on the organism or the cell type. There's a problem in the problem book, 3.6, which considers what happens if the protein goes into the matrix and then comes back. Because if it goes into the matrix and comes back out again, it can either get stuck in the inner membrane, forming a transmembrane protein, or it can go all the way through and form a protein inside the intramembrane space. Now, all of this raises the question of how many signals does it take to do this? Clearly, you need a transit peptide to get this into the matrix. But if the protein inserts into this membrane, it needs another signal. And if it crosses that membrane and then does something else, it might need another. So you might need more than one signal. You might need a transit peptide, which is removed, exposing another signal that says stick in the membrane. And this problem is about that. So what we're saying here is that to get to the right place in a mitochondrion, you need a transit peptide, but you might need more. You need a transit peptide to get into the matrix. Now, I'd like to leave mitochondria just to say that chloroplasts are very similar, except that chloroplasts have three membranes. They make a few more proteins than a mitochondrion does, but still the bulk of their proteins come from the outside. And the problem exists of targeting each protein to the right compartment within the organelle. Now, are there any questions about this before we move to peroxisomes? Yeah?
What is the, you're talking about the getting the proteins into the lysosomes. You said that to get into the ER, it requires a signal, the first signal. But why does it require that signal?
His question is, why do you need two signals, again, to get to a lysosome? When a protein is made, it needs a signal for that ribosome to attach to the ER. It doesn't attach to the ER by itself. So the first signal you need is the signal peptide that binds the signal recognition particle that ferries the ribosome to the ER. So you would need that for a protein that goes to any part of the endomembrane system. That would be the first step. But then you might have additional signals saying go to this part, that part, another. Okay. Now, what about peroxisomes? In a way, the easiest way to do that is to add them to our table. What do they look like? And then we'll consider how do you get the proteins inside. Well, you may remember that peroxisomes look just like lysosomes. They're more or less the same size and look extremely similar. So they have one membrane. And when I say one membrane, how many bilayers is that? That's one. Is it a monolayer? It's not a monolayer. It's two monolayers or a bilayer. Now, do peroxisomes have DNA? They do not. However, they appear to grow and split. It's possibly that some of them are made de novo from scratch, but most of the time what we've seen is that peroxisomes appear to accumulate more and more material, and when they get large enough, they subdivide. Now, where do their proteins come from? Since they have no DNA, they can't make any of their own at all. All of the proteins of peroxisomes are made on the cytoplasmic ribosomes. So how does the protein get into the peroxisome? As with mitochondria, the protein is made first, and then it wiggles after synthesis. So it's post-translational insert into peroxisomes. Now, there is some indication that for a protein to enter a peroxisome, it does not need to unfold. We don't know how that works or if that's right, but that implies that you don't have to straighten it out, wiggle it through, and fold it up again. You basically fold it up, and somehow you make a hole in the pore, you make a hole in the membrane, and you put it through. Now, we do know that with nuclear pores, the pores are to some extent expandable. So it may be something like that, that the pore is pushed open and the protein goes through. It takes energy. But exactly how that's used is not clear. Now, what is the signal that says take me to a peroxisome. It also is a sequence in the protein, but it's generally on the carboxyl end as opposed to the amino end. And it's generally not removed. And it has the name of peroxisomal localization signal. Now, this could have been called a mitochondrial localization signal or a matrix localization signal. This could have been called an ER localization signal, but they have special names because of the way they were discovered. Now, there is a table in your notes which compares all the various signals, which is at the end somewhere in the middle. We're not going to go over it here, but it's there for reference, so you don't have to worry about getting all of this stuff quite right. Now, since we're talking about putting enzymes into peroxisomes, what are those enzymes anyway? What's inside a peroxisome? Now, I think we explained earlier that there are two ways of identifying what's in an organelle. One is the basic grind and find biochemical fractionation method, and one is in situ assays. Now, until recently, people could do in situ assays, but they were still not absolutely sure that there were two different distinct classes of organelles, lysosomes and peroxisomes. And that's because, as we also mentioned before, not only are peroxisomes and lysosomes the same size, but they're also the same density. They have the same ratio of protein to lipid, and so they're extremely hard to separate. In fact, straight off, there is no way to separate them. And what people wanted to do was to, in fact, separate them in some way so that you had a test tube full of peroxisomes and a test tube full of lysosomes, and you could break each sample open and measure what enzymes are inside. In order to do that, you have to be able to separate them. So the trick to that was actually done with intact animals, rats or I think rats. You feed them triton. Triton is a detergent. Triton is a detergent, meaning it's an amphipathic molecule. It has a lipid-like tail and a hydrophilic end. So what happens is that this compound accumulates in lysosomes. It doesn't build up in peroxisomes. So normally, peroxisomes and lysosomes are not only the same size, but they have the same ratio of protein to lipid. Probably should write it the other way around, lipid to protein. This is the same for both of them. But if you have lysosomes from a rat that's been eating triton, the peroxisomes are the same, but the lysosomes are packed with triton. And remember, triton is a sort of fake lipid. And so the result is that there is more hydrophobic lipid-like stuff in here. And so the lipid to protein ratio is higher. Now, the size hasn't changed, but the ratio of lipid to protein has. And what is that effect? That's going to affect the density. So instead of having the same density, now the lysosomes are going to be lighter than the peroxisomes because the lysosomes have more lipid for the same amount of protein. So how are you going to separate these two? They're the same size, but they differ in density. What technique can you use to separate them? What can you say? Centrifugation. She says, it's centrifugation, but there are two kinds of centrifugation. There's sedimentation velocity and there's equilibrium density. Well, the name sort of gives it away. You want to do equilibrium density. Since they're the same size, they would move at the same rate probably. But since they have different densities, if you float them in a solution, as in the Messelson-Stahl experiment, they're going to float at different points. And so it's possible to physically separate the two sets of vesicles and identify the enzymes that are inside. Now, we know that the enzymes of lysosomes are primarily acid hydrolases, And the enzymes, what's in a peroxisome? Well, I think we've already mentioned that they have oxidases and catalase. Now, I want to say a word about their function, but before I do that, I want to say a word about identification. We mentioned earlier when we were talking about the Golgi, about the concept of a marker enzyme, an enzyme that is characteristic of a particular organelle or part of the cell. Marker enzymes are used because they're characteristic, they're always found in that subcellular compartment, and because they're easy to measure. And the most common marker enzyme for peroxisomes is urate oxidase. What the real significance and function of this enzyme is not known. We happen to know that peroxisomes in animal cells have it, and it's easy to measure, and so it's used as a marker, but its real job is not clear at all. For lysosomes, you can use any hydrolase, and it's common to use acid phosphatase. Now, we know what lysosomes do, but what do peroxisomes do? Peroxisomes do different things in different organisms, but in animal cells, one of their major functions is to carry out detoxification. And they do that in several stages, but a critical part is oxidation. If you have a compound which is reduced, it is generally lipid-soluble and hydrophobic. But if you oxidize it, take off the hydrogens, then you get a compound which is much more hydrophilic and much more water-soluble. And what the oxidases in the peroxisomes do is to carry out these reactions. And there are a bunch of different oxidases for different R. Now, why does this work? Things that are lipid-soluble tend to accumulate either in membranes or in your body fat because they dissolve there, and they just sit there, and they tend not to be washed out. Things that are water-soluble, if they get into the blood, then get into the urine and are, in fact, excreted. And so the liver and other cells carry out these oxidations and then secrete these oxidized compounds. They're actively transported into the blood or the bile so they can be excreted. So first you have to solubilize the stuff, and then you have to put it into the liquid part of the body so it can be removed. Now, this works. Now, notice that this is different from the oxidations we talked about last semester. Last semester, we talked about energy metabolism, like glycolysis and the electron transport. Usually, everything that happened was removing hydrogens, and it was given to NAD or to FAD. There was very little oxygen on the premises at all, except in the last stage of oxidative phosphorylation. Almost all oxidations of traditional energy metabolism are really dehydrogenations. But this is a real oxidation using molecular oxygen. The catch to that, though, is it generates peroxide. Peroxide is very reactive and very destructive. So the second famous enzyme in the peroxisome, catalase, is used to degrade the peroxide. This is the reaction catalyzed by catalase. Instead of using oxygen as an oxidizing agent, it uses peroxide. The peroxide picks up the hydrogens, and now you have water, which is harmless, and you've oxidized something. Now, this is a version of this, is that this R'H2 can itself be peroxide. So the reaction could be this, peroxide plus peroxide. And in this case, you see R actually is oxygen. So you end up with oxygen plus 2 water. Now, the advantage of this version of the reaction is that you've gotten rid of the peroxide and you've regenerated oxygen. So if you carry out these two together, the net effect is to oxidize the compound and make it toxin and make it more soluble, and to destroy the peroxide and regenerate oxygen to do another go-round of oxidations. So the oxidase plus the catalase make a good combination. Now, this detoxification business is generally good news. It means that toxins that you eat in your food are destroyed. But it also sometimes leads to destroying drugs, so that the drug is oxidized and excreted before it has any effect. And variations in this process account in part for different people's responses to drugs. Some people degrade or oxidize the drugs very quickly, some people do not. Now, not all detoxification takes place in peroxisomes. Some of it also takes place on the surface of the ER. But the principle is the same, that what you want to do is oxidize the compound so it'll be more soluble so you can get rid of it. And occasionally, what you oxidize is something you don't want to get rid of. Now, perhaps the only part of the peroxisome we haven't considered is the peroxisome gets its proteins from the free ribosomes. Where does it get its lipid from? It makes some, but some of its lipid comes from the ER. We mentioned before that most of the cell's lipid is made on the surface of the ER and then carried to other parts of the cell. Vesicles go to the other parts of the endomembrane system, and they carry lipid as well as protein. Carrier or exchange proteins are thought also to bind lipid and carry that lipid over to the organelles that are not part of the endomembrane system. These proteins bind lipid at the ER and let go of lipid at the mitochondria and the peroxisomes, thereby delivering the necessary lipid to make up the membrane. Now, I want to talk about that last class now, how proteins get into nuclei. But before I do that, let's ask if there are questions before I go on. Yeah?
How do those reactions, those proteins relate? Are they, is the first and the third one?
Well, if you did this one twice and then did this one once, you would end up oxidizing two molecules of RH2 and regenerating the oxygen. And you would regenerate one of the oxygens and have water. If you're worried about it doesn't exactly balance, no, it doesn't. Okay. Yeah. Why does detergent go to lysosomes? Now, I don't know the exact answer to that. But many things that come into the cell from the outside end up in lysosomes. And so one assumes that these things look like a phospholipid. Perhaps they insert in membranes, then there's endocytosis, and then that lipid eventually ends up in endosomes and then in lysosomes. But the real answer is that I don't know. I don't think this was done on purpose. I think this was discovered by accident. Why they fed the poor rats Triton in the first place, I don't know. But it happens to be our good fortune that it accumulates in one organelle and not the other. Yeah? There's no reason to think that lipid would go to... if it acts like a regular lipid, maybe it would get spread all over and end up in the membranes of everything. The fact that it ends up in lysosomes probably means that the triton is not being treated as an ordinary lipid, but is being treated as some kind of foreign substance which is targeted to receptors which then go to endosomes and then to lysosomes. But maybe I'll see if I can find this one out, but I don't know the answer. Okay. So what about nuclei? All the proteins that are inside nuclei actually come from the cytoplasm. So how do they get there? We want to go back and look at the structure of the nucleus. When we draw the nuclear membrane, we usually draw something that looks more or less like this. So we have the two membranes, the inner and outer nuclear membrane. And then we have spaces where there are pores which connect the inside of the nucleus with the cytoplasm. Now, these pores are actually quite complicated structures. And we'll explain their structure in a minute. They have a small constant opening which acts like a channel for small molecules. So small molecules enter passively, things like the nucleoside triphosphates that are needed to make DNA and RNA. They come in down their gradient passively through these channels. But the remainder of the pore is capable of widening and transporting large things like proteins. And this is an active process. So the transport of macromolecules is an active process requiring the splitting of GTP, which is equivalent in energy to ATP. Now, to see how this setup works, you can see that what it looks sort of like is if you originally had two membranes, and then you sort of punched a hole through, and the membranes sealed. But I think it's easier to see this in three dimensions. So this is our nucleus today. It's not a cell, this is the nucleus, and these are the pores. Now, there'd probably be more pores than this if this were a real nucleus. They're really quite thick on the membrane. But I've only put on a few because I wanted to get the idea across. So in through here would be a pore, in through here, etc. Now, the picture that we get there we get from slicing the thing in half. And some of the slices go through one of the pores. And because they go through the pore, that's why you see this. Now, what does it really look like? How do you join two membranes? These are meant to be the two membranes, inner membrane of the nucleus, outer membrane of the nucleus. If you had two of them, what we're really saying is that each of these is sort of like a doggy door, you know, or a cat door, you know. Like so. So we have two of them. And if you go through both of them at once, you make a kind of hole if you keep the membranes fused like that. But you have to keep something inside to keep it open. That's the whole point of the doggy door. When the dog leaves, it reseals. So there actually is a proteinaceous structure inside that holds it open. So this is what the whole thing sort of looks like. I made this, but it's a little small, so we'll use the big one. The idea is this would have been one membrane. This would have been the other membrane. And when we punched the hole through, the two membranes became sealed. And so they're sealed. The hole from the top looks like this. When you see it from the side, what's happened is it's been cut this way. So you see this on one side and this on the other. That's what these are. So the two membranes are fused at a pore. But as we indicated before, when I took my hand out, it closed. This is held with scotch tape. What really holds it open is a protein structure of the nuclear pore. So that works better with the small one, with a bagel again. Now, this is different from gap junctions. Gap junctions is the two bagel model. You have a bagel sticking out from each membrane, and the two bagels fuse. Two bagels join. Here there's only one bagel. There's one structure with a hole in it, and it fits in the middle of the two fused membranes, and it holds them open so that the membrane remains fused all the way around, and there's a hole in the middle, and the structure is held open. So that means, we look from the top again, you see the hole and you see the protein structure. This structure is quite complex. And if you look in Becker, or I think also in Purvis, they have a drawing of what this actually looks like. It's quite complicated. But now in a picture like that, you got that by slicing across here. So what you see, this is the fused membrane. That's a fused membrane, and there was a bagel in here, but we cut the bagel in half. So it's as if this were inside, but it's behind the board. So what you would see would be the two cut ends of the protein. You wouldn't see the rest of the protein, because it would be behind the board. So it would fit in here, and here would be one seal, and here's the other sealed member. So that's the basic structure of pores. As we said, there's a fixed kind of channel here that small molecules just go down their gradient through. But this structure is also complicated and can apparently stretch, and that's how big molecules go through. So we want to look for a minute at how that works. In addition to the protein that makes up the pore, there's a protein you need to get in, and there's a different protein that things need, other transportable proteins need to get out. And these two transport proteins are called importin. That's the protein you use for import into the nucleus, or going into the nucleus, and exportin, which is the protein used for coming out of the nucleus. Now, how do you recognize a protein that's supposed to go to the nucleus? It has to have a take me to the nucleus sequence. It has to have what is called a nuclear localization signal, or an NLS, for nuclear localization signal. Now, it'd probably better to call this a nuclear import signal, because that's what you need to stick to importin and go in. To get out of the nucleus, you have to stick to exportin. And you have to have a specific sequence in the protein, which is called a nuclear exit sequence, or an NES. So these are the two localization signals that get you in or out of the nucleus. Now, this works each case. When you move in or you move out, you have to split GTP. It takes energy to change the conformation of the various proteins and move you through. How do the importin and the exportin fit in? They're actually middlemen. And they're very much parallel to a situation we met before. If you have a protein with a signal peptide, then the ribosome, with the protein with the signal peptide is supposed to go over to the ER and attach, and the protein is supposed to wiggle through the translocon as it's made. How do you get this structure stuck to the ER? It turns out that this signal peptide doesn't stick directly to the ER. The signal peptide sticks to the signal recognition particle. The signal recognition particle sticks to its receptor, gets everything stuck, and then the signal recognition particle leaves, and the signal peptide goes into the translocon. So you have, in this case, a particle which carries the protein with the right signal over to where it's supposed to go. The signal recognition particle makes the match between the protein on the ribosome and the translocon complex. In the same way, importin makes a match between the protein with the nuclear localization signal and the pore. Importin helps the protein bind to the pore so that it can then wiggle in. Similarly, exportin does the reverse. A protein that's inside sticks to exportin. The exportin sticks to the pore, and then the protein can wiggle out. Now, nuclear localization signals are not removed. Now, why should that be? Once you get a protein into the nucleus, does the nucleus stay there forever? What happens in mitosis? During mitosis, we actually disassemble the nucleus and the nuclear membrane and push the parts aside, carry out, line up the chromosomes, attach the microtubules, move everything around, and then we put the nuclear membrane back. So the protein that's supposed to be in the nucleus might find itself floating around in the cytoplasm somewhere at the end of mitosis and have to go back into the nucleus. So the nuclear localization signal is not removed. It apparently can be anywhere on the protein. It isn't always on one end or the other. It can be anywhere, and it stays there permanently because you may need it again. Now, there's another piece here that we want to add. If this is the nucleus, there's some other features in there like the chromatin and the nucleolus, but we won't get to that till next time. But we've already mentioned lamins a couple of times, and the lamins are the intermediate filaments that are here. Now that we know a little bit more, where are these made? Where do you think? These are in the inside of the nucleus, so they, in fact, should come from the cytoplasm. They should be made on free ribosomes in the cytoplasm with a nuclear localization signal and then carried inside. Now, on the exam, excuse me for mentioning it, there was a protein called emerin. And most of you figured out that that protein is located here as a transmembrane protein in the inner nuclear membrane. Yes, that is where it is. Not in part one. Part one, it was on the cytoplasmic membrane. So how does that protein get there? Where was that protein made? It may be clearer if I put it over here. That remember that this membrane is continuous with the membrane of the ER. And this is a transmembrane protein. Now, you weren't asked this, of course. But the most likely possibility is that this membrane is actually part of the ER. It's part of the endomembrane system. And that this protein was made on a ribosome attached to the ER. And the protein was inserted into the ER as it was made. And then, probably by lateral diffusion, it ended up inside. And it gets trapped there because it binds to lamin. Okay. Now, we've talked about these intermediate filaments before, but we've just raised an issue that maybe we should deal with. Just as the proteins inside have to get out of the way when you do mitosis, so does this lamina or nuclear cortex have to get out of the way. In fact, what happens during mitosis is that these intermediate filaments are broken into smaller pieces, either dimers or tetramers or monomers. And you're basically taking the cable apart into its Legos, piling the Legos on the outside, on the side, carrying out the rest of mitosis, and then you're going to put it back again. So how are you going to change these from polymers to monomers? The secret seems to be phosphorylation. We said before that one way of changing the properties of a protein is either to put a phosphate on or to take a phosphate off. These proteins are modified by adding a phosphate during mitosis. You may remember that the last part of interphase is called G2. It's the end of interphase. At this time, a bunch of kinases in the cell are activated. And so a whole bunch of proteins, not just these, are phosphorylated. And as a result, the proteins change conformation. Some get tighter, some get looser, but they get into a form more appropriate for mitosis. And in particular, the lamins depolymerize. And then the phosphorylated one, depolymerized ones are pushed aside. In anaphase, which is near the end of mitosis, the kinases become inactive and a bunch of phosphatases become active. These phosphatases remove the phosphates from the laminins, That allows the lamins to polymerize and reform the cortex and support and reform the membrane. And as we'll see, there are other proteins which go through the same cyclic behavior of being phosphorylated at the end of interphase and dephosphorylated at the end of mitosis. Now we're going to stop here, and what we're going to do next time is get to the parts that we didn't get to about chromatin and the nucleolus, and then we're going to talk about the regulation of genes.
Let's do a question. I'm trying to figure out how to kind of visualize the signaling. Is that a